So my topic this evening, as was said, is freedom beyond civility, providing the better answers to today's social questions. 50 years ago, when Neil Armstrong set foot on the moon, the Western world had entered only a few years into the sexual revolution. Its consequences were not yet certain. Although there were prophets in the 1960s who raised their voices in warning over what the sexual revolution would bring, Pope St. Paul VI was one of them, few foresaw the social and political turmoil that the revolution would create far into the future. Just 50 years later, we can review the revolution's history with some clarity. The results have not been good. Society continues to wrestle with confusion not only over sex, but also, in consequence, it wrestles with questions over the dignity of human life and the sanctity and permanence of marriage. The revolution's commodification and manipulation of sex on an industrial scale has led ineluctably to the commodification and manipulation of persons, resulting tragically in today's throwaway culture, condemned by Pope Francis. And that's not all. Weeds of the revolution continue to sprout. Recently, the nature of gender has emerged as yet another revolution-fueled source of unease and uncertainty. According to its promoters, the popular displacement of sex from marriage was supposed to liberate man and woman, to enjoy each other with greater confidence and freedom. Instead, men and women today find themselves further alienated from each other than we can remember. Just think of the Me Too movement. Increasingly, men and women confront their tests of difference as tournaments of power, failing to see in sexual difference a principle of man and woman's unity and love. Abortion and divorce remain popular solutions to the problem of man and woman. And gender theory seeks to solve the problem at its root by deconstructing man and woman altogether. We're learning the hard way that adding the letter X to words, especially to pronouns, doesn't change reality. It only makes pronouns and other words unpronounceable and unintelligible. 50 years into the sexual revolution, we can trace the wild ride on which it has taken society, leading to much sorrow and tumult. Ironically, the liberation of our sexual powers has led to the eclipse of sexual difference. Those powers by which man and woman unite most intimately and by which they reproduce themselves now vex us to the point that for many of our contemporaries, it seems plausible to deny altogether that men and women even exist. It is against this background of social sorrow and confusion that we should understand our current political moment. Today's lack of civility in the public square, a bad fruit of a growing political tribalism in society, has not developed in a vacuum. We haven't simply lost our manners. We are wrestling socially and politically with questions that touch on the very nature, identity, and dignity of the human person. Man is either at home in nature, a creature of nature's God, or he is a blank canvas to be covered in self-expression. Our nation was founded according to the former conception of man. We are now experimenting with the latter conception. Which conception will prevail is not yet clear. What is clear is that until this question is solved, the peace and tranquility that fosters civility will be in short supply. Come to Hillsdale, I wish I would have more and happier news to report, but I'm afraid I don't. Till the question of man is solved, at least adequately, if not completely, we'll argue about how best to maneuver in our current uncertainty. We'll disagree, among other things, over the place that civility should retain in our unsettled state. A good example of this disagreement is the debate that erupted in late May between Sarab Amari, the op-ed editor of the New York Post, and David French, a senior writer at National Review. Actually, senior writer up until recently at National Review. He recently stepped down to begin a new project. Both men, Amari and French, are Christians. They find their home on the political right, but they disagree over the role that civility should play in our current political moment. Since their debate erupted in early summer, Amari and French have faced off in two debates, both held in September. The first took place at the Catholic University of America in Washington, the second at the University of Notre Dame. In both debates, Amari and French defined their terms and refined their arguments, but in neither debate did their differences stand out as they did in their initial exchange. For that reason, I suggest that we review that initial exchange this evening. There we see the raw tension emerging on the American and Christian right over how best politically and socially to confront not only the sexual revolution, but also, and more generally, what appear, to some at least, as the decreasing dividends of liberty. On May 28th, David French published a brief article entitled "Decency is No Barrier to Justice or the Common Good." In it, French highlights a lesson he learned as a young lawyer. After a tough loss in court, his boss and mentor, a lawyer under whom French had worked on the case, called the opposing counsel to, quote, acknowledge their work, their sacrifice, and their victory. That gesture of magnanimity and civility left a deep impression on the young French. It became clear to him then that no legal loss is worth the cost of failing to recognize the humanity and goodwill of one's opponents. Transferring that lesson to today's political arena, fraught as it is with suspicion and acrimony, French wonders in his article, what do politeness, respect, and dignity cost anyone? Civility, French argues, is always an expense that we can afford. For French, there is no greater example of the practicality of this lesson than today's pro-life movement. He writes, quote, the pro-life movement advanced through love. Love for mother and child. And while no one should shrink from telling hard truths, the movement does not advance through scorn. Indeed, every hateful advocate for life sets the movement back. The violent and scornful men and women were the movement's greatest liability. When lives are at stake, you reach out to people with your whole heart. End of quote. In light of what he sees as the inherent goodness and practicality of civility, especially as it has benefited the pro-life movement, French doesn't accept the ridicule of his critics, those who call him and those like him too polite or a squish. He doesn't agree with those who claim that he, quote, doesn't fight, just because he insists on remaining civil in the cultural and political battle. In his article, French disagrees particularly with Sarab Amari, who had recently tweeted, quote, there is no polite David Frenchian third way around the cultural civil war. The only way is through. French laments Amari's sentiment. not because it refers to him personally, but because it denigrates civility. We live in a strange time, French writes, when fighting for fundamental liberties while treating other human beings respectfully is seen as a sign of weakness. To the contrary, French argues in conclusion of his essay, we must vindicate our core values without violating our core values. And I don't want any part in any conservative movement that holds otherwise. It is possible that Amari did not intend to launch a public debate on civility with his tweet, but he did. French responded to Amari in full. Now it was Amari's turn to respond to French. The next day, May 29th, Amari published Against David Frenchism at the First Things website. In his response to French, Amari argues that French's concern for civility and politeness overlooks the needs of the current political moment. Civility and politeness are wonderful, Amari allows, but not when the traditionally neutral spaces of civil society, in which politeness supplied a necessary common language, are no longer neutral or polite. Amari writes, French believes that the institutions of a technocratic market society are neutral zones that should, in theory, accommodate both traditional Christianity and the libertine ways and paganized ideology of the other side. Even if the latter, that is, the libertine and the pagan, predominate in elite institutions, French figures, then at least the former, traditional Christians, should be granted spaces in which to practice and preach what they sincerely believe. Amari continues, well, it doesn't work out that way. And it hasn't been working out that way for a long time, as French well knows, since he has spent a considerable part of his career admirably and passionately advocating for Christians coercively squeezed out of the public square. In that time, we have won discrete victories, but the overall balance of forces has tilted inexorably away from us. And I think that the Frenchian model bears some of the responsibility, some of the blame. To illustrate his point, Amari points to the growing popularity of drag queen reading hours at public libraries. Amari argues that the current maximization of individual liberty that we are now seeing in the culture, a maximization that he claims French supports and promotes, is bad for the family, is bad for the church, and is bad for tradition. It is the maximization of liberty, Amari contends, that chases civility and politeness from the public square. In American society, civility and politeness have been the protectors of traditional norms and behaviors. And so as traditional norms and behaviors are jettisoned by the culture, so too are their protectors. Which is precisely what we're seeing today, Amari argues. Now that traditional norms and customs have given way, along with the civility and politeness that protected them, public life has coarsened, not only by new libertine customs, but also by charges of bias and bigotry lodged against traditional and religious communities. According to Amari, progressive individualism follows a certain logic. Its proponents make arguments like this. For us to feel fully autonomous, you must positively affirm our sexual choices, our transgression, our power to disfigure our natural bodies, and redefine what it means to be human, lest your disapprobation make us feel less than fully autonomous. This is strikingly similar to how Henri-Dominique Lacordaire articulated the arguments of French secularists in 1840. Lacordaire was a French priest and Dominican who brought the Order of Preachers back to France after the French Revolution. Lacordaire summarized the stance of his opponents thus, We must conquer you because we hate you. We shall not employ fire and sword against you, but by means of the law we shall put you out of the protection of the law. We shall represent your devotedness as a privilege dangerous to the state and to be gotten rid of by ostracism. You shall have no share in liberty because your virtues have raised you beyond equality. Against this progressive and secularist logic now operative in 21st century America, Amari warns that the traditional carve-outs for religious liberty will last only a while. He writes, "If the moral law is merely a matter of ancient, if sincere conviction, then of course it must give way to the demands for autonomy of people in the here and now." To bolster his argument, Amari quotes Archbishop Charles Chaput of Philadelphia, who recently observed, "If traditional moral precepts are purely religious beliefs, then they can't be rationally defended. And because they're rationally indefensible, they should be treated as a form of prejudice." Thus 2,000 years of moral truth and religious principle become, by sleight of hand, a species of bias. In the end, Amari's frustration with French is rooted in French's preferred solution to the problem of maximized autonomy, which is more autonomy. Amari argues instead that the political community, not just the family or the church, has its own good and its own legitimacy, and these should be fought for and defended against the demands of progressive and expressive individualism. The political ground upon which a society stands is not neutral. It can never be neutral. For the political good, social health, and communal flourishing are not neutral. Communities and the individuals that live in them are either growing or dying. For Amari, then, fighting for the political good requires just that, fighting. Civility and politeness have their place in the public square and in public life, but not at the expense of ceding the common ground and the common good to the claims of autonomy. Amari writes, "Progressives understand that culture war means discrediting their opponents and weakening or destroying their institutions. Conservatives should approach the culture war with a similar realism. Civility and decency are secondary values. They regulate compliance with an established order and orthodoxy. We should seek to use these values to enforce our order and our orthodoxy, not pretend that they could ever be neutral. To recognize that enmity is real is its own kind of moral duty." In other words, why should traditional peoples be civil with those who wish to delegitimize their civic standing and drive them from the civic space? Why deal civilly with those who seek, in the words of Lacordaire, to ostracize traditional peoples and put them out of the protection of the law? The next day, May 30th, French responded to Amari in an extended essay entitled, "What Sohrab Amari Gets Wrong." And it French defends his appeal for civility. French begins by accusing Amari of building his critique of civility on two fictional characters: a fictional David French, weaker than in real life, and a fictional Donald Trump, more philosophically disciplined than in real life. To the first fictional character, French says that his real life self is more combative than Amari admits. French defends his record of accomplishment. He points to his often contentious engagement with illiberalism in courtrooms and classrooms around the country. And in both realms, in lawsuits and in debates, French argues that persuasion wins the day. Not always, French admits. But he argues that persuasion works better than what he thinks Amari advocates, which French calls a punch in the face populism. To the second fictional character, the philosophically disciplined Donald Trump, French rebuts Amari's claim that Trump seeks to govern consistently from a principled political philosophy, one that rejects, quote, autonomy above all, and promotes instead, quote, order, continuity, and social cohesion, which sees a role for government in a kind of self-defense to preserve order, continuity, and social cohesion against forces that would undermine order, continuity, and cohesion. French finds Amari's claim laughable because, even though he doesn't quite explain why, except to assert that serial divorcers who bed porn stars are incapable of thinking such high thoughts. Although history may not support this claim, Aristotle, it's true, says something to this effect. French summarizes Amari's view of the choice that confronts us. Quote, in one corner is the nice milquetoast libertarian David French. In the other corner is the strong instrument of social cohesion, Donald Trump. If this were, in fact, the choice we confront, French says that he too, then, would side with Trump. But this isn't an accurate description of our current political moment, according to French. To his mind, nothing much has changed since the American founding. What the fathers built in 1791, French claims, serves us well in 2019. Thus, the political task before the Christian conservative is twofold: to pursue a zealous defense of the classical liberal order, with a special emphasis on civil liberties, as well as a zealous advocacy of fundamentally Christian and Burkean conservative principles. In other words, our task is to defend the structure of the neutral public square, and in it we advocate through civility and persuasion for natural and revealed truth. Not only is this in keeping with the ideals of the American founding, French argues, but it is in keeping with, quote, scriptural admonitions to love your enemies, to bless those who persecute you, with full knowledge that, in the words of St. Paul, the Lord's servant must be kind to everyone, able to teach, and patiently endure evil. For French, these admonitions are not mere tactics to try until they fail. Rather, they are commands to God's people that do not admit of political exceptions. As a substitute to Amari's view of the choice that confronts us, French versus Trump, French proposes his own. Quote, we can forsake a commitment to liberty and launch the political version of the Battle of Verdun, seeking the ruin of our foes, or we can recommit to our shared citizenship and preserve a space for all American voices, even as we compete against those voices in politics and in the marketplace of ideas. And the choice is set up this way. French is clear as to what side he takes. He defends the neutral public square, the centerpiece of the liberal order, where citizens are free to exercise their inalienable civil rights. Amari and French left the debate there until September, when they faced off twice in public debates. As I mentioned earlier, these debates did little to settle their differences, but they did clarify the terms of the debate. Both Amari and French agree that civility is the guardian of the neutrality of the public square. For French, who defends the neutral public square, civility is what is required to welcome and protect all voices in public life, even when those voices compete for influence. For Amari, however, it's not civility that poses the problem, but rather the supposed neutrality of the public square. To his view, the public square is never neutral. At every moment, it is aimed at either virtue or vice, at human flourishing or human diminishment. For this reason, Amari argues that when the public square is bent on vice, French's civility at all costs gives cover to evil forces that should at least be resisted. More properly for Amari, these forces should be repudiated. In the hands of the vicious, the banner of civility does not protect the Christian. In the hands of the vicious, civility is unfurled to smother those who would fight for the good. When we look at the Amari-French debate, we can see that both thinkers get something right. What Amari gets right is this, I think. In fact, the public square is not neutral. Why? Because the human being is not neutral. He is, by virtue of his creation in the image and likeness of God, oriented to the good. He is not neutral to the good. To choose the good leads to happiness and flourishing. To choose evil leads to sorrow and diminishment. No person, and by extension, no social grouping, the family, the city, can remain neutral to the good. States can choose not to erect legal structures leading citizens to the good and diverting them from evil, as liberal states do. But the neutral spaces thus created are legal fictions. These spaces do not neutralize the human heart, and they cannot neutralize citizens or states to the real goods that perfect man and the real evils that harm him. Like persons, states must follow the first principle of practical reason: to do good and to avoid evil. Now, this is not to say that all neutrality in the public square is fictional. There is a way in which some government neutrality can and does serve the common good. And this is what I would add to Amari's argument. It is legitimate to wish government to remain neutral when dealing with comparable things, as the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment attempts to do in the realm of religion. The federal government remains neutral when comparing Catholics and Baptists and Anglicans and Presbyterians. It remains neutral even when comparing churches and synagogues and mosques. But this neutrality need not extend to the comparison of things that aren't comparable, like pencils and cigarettes, for example. Naturally and non-neutrally, the former, pencils, we hand out in schools, while the latter, cigarettes, we do not. So whereas the Establishment Clause remains viewpoint neutral regarding Catholics and Protestants, for example, must that neutrality extend also to Catholicism and Satanism? Are these two comparable, such that government cannot distinguish between the two? Likewise, whereas viewpoint neutrality might allow for an Aristotle reading hour, a Nietzsche reading hour, a New Testament reading hour, and a Quran reading hour to be held in the same public library, must that neutrality extend also to drag queen reading hour? Is the latter reading hour comparable to the former reading hour, such that government cannot distinguish the latter from the former? To be sure, justice should remain blind, but her blindness should not render her ignorant or mute. What French gets right in the debate, I think, is this. Civility remains of prime importance in civic life. St. Thomas Aquinas recognized this centuries ago. The fellow citizen is by nature a friend. He should therefore be treated as a friend. We gain help and strength to form civic friendships when we develop the political forms of the moral virtues: political prudence, political fortitude, political temperance, and what Aquinas calls general or legal justice. In strengthening our love for and grasp of the common good, the political forms of the moral virtues equip us to engage with those with whom we share the common good as friends. For Aquinas, the orientation to friendship is the default political position. Accordingly, the fellow citizen does not become an enemy until he takes direct and grave action against the common good. And even then, Aquinas says, mercy and clemency should shape the exercise of justice. When we put these two points together, Amari's point and French's point, I think we can develop a course of action in our unsettled time. That course of action is this: to promote the good vigorously in civic exchange. This is not just a defense of the good, a carving out of space for the good, but it's real promotion. The goal is to go on Amari's offensive, but with French's civility. An example of this, I believe, may be found in a newly published book, Mary Hirschfeld's Aquinas and the Market. A trained economist and theologian, Hirschfeld takes on in this work the philosophical shortcomings of predominant economic thinking, especially that thinking born from what is called rational choice theory. This theory, Hirschfeld claims, makes serious mistakes about the human person, truncating our appreciation of the breadth of human knowing and loving. Simplistic in its view of man, the theory contributes to simplistic views of man's economic activity. To correct this shortcoming in economic thinking, Hirschfeld does not raise the science of economics, slashing its errors and burning its idols. Rather, through engaging the concerns of rational choice theory, she demonstrates how Aristotelian Thomistic philosophy and anthropology and the economic ideas we can draw from them do a better job of answering the concerns of rational choice theory or rational choice theorists than their own theory. By examining the essentially social and political nature of man and the inherent connection between the market and the common good, as well as the perfection that prudence brings to human choice, Hirschfeld points the way to an understanding of economics that surpasses the reductive and individualistic accounts standard today. It's important to know that in her book, Hirschfeld adopts the philosophical and theological method of St. Thomas Aquinas. She follows the structure of a question as Aquinas asks it and answers it in the Summa Theologiae. He begins with objections, then he examines true teaching, and finally he replies to the objections in the light of true teaching. In every question, Aquinas arrives at articulating the truth through examining opposing opinions. The objections that Aquinas raises at the beginning of each question are not straw men, designed by Aquinas to bolster his argument. They are the real opinions, logically argued to by intelligent persons. Nor does Aquinas use the objections simply as foils for his already established opinion. Aquinas enters deeply into a consideration of these opinions, seeking to understand them from the inside. He draws out what is true in them, especially their concern for the good that they seek. But then, in the course of presenting his own answer to a question, Aquinas demonstrates how his answer resolves the objector's concerns better than their own answers. The result is a vigorous promotion of the truth, civilly presented as the better answer to deeply held concerns or worries. I would argue that this, my friends, is the task that lies before the Christian or the traditional believer in the public square. It's not to engage in the dance of liberal civility, nor to decimate perceived enemies wherever they appear. Rather, knowing the needs of nature and of the human heart from below, and knowing the saving truth given from above, the task of the believer is always to present the better answers to the questions that press on our public life. In print, in speech, in the arts, ours is the task to speak the full truth of God and man, the full truth of man and woman, and the full truth of economics and politics, the truth that aims beyond civility to engage reality and to set people free. Thank you all for listening.
We have time for a couple questions.
All right. Sure.
So I think I'm a little bit confused about what Amari's idea of aggression and what French's idea of civility are. Because it seems like Amari's not saying we should just start calling the other side bad names.
Right.
And it seems like with the drag queen example, there's definitely room to, if the library is having a meeting about whether or not to do a drag queen story arc, it's totally fine to make a very strong, fight as hard as you can to keep that from happening while still exercising that. There's still room for civility there.
Mm-hmm.
So if you could talk a little bit about what exactly they mean by civility and aggression.
Sure. I think you're right. I mean, that's why I focused on the initial exchange. I think it's much clearer where they're each coming from. If you watch the debate at CUA, it was a little acrimonious, but I found that they were talking past each other. And then the debate at Notre Dame, it was too sanitized at that point. They were really behaving themselves at that point, where I don't think their real differences came to the fore. I do think on certain, at one level, they're just talking past each other. And I think because of that, there's a lot more agreement between the two of them than when, I guess Amari at least would like to admit. Though I think Amari, I mean, is set in his critique that the defensive posture that traditional peoples take within the public square is not a kind of a stance that can be sustained for long. That in the face of, I think what Amari brings to the table is that there's an understanding that political, liberal structures, liberal institutions are in themselves somewhat malleable. They can function and work according to a kind of anthropology that informs the people, at least, who are kind of pulling the levers of power. And so there's a legitimate way in which, you know, a liberal institution can be pointed toward good and virtue, but in the hands of the vicious, those same institutions are going to be pointed towards vice and ruin. With that in the background, with that understanding, if Amari's right, he's saying that then there needs to be not just when things are turning towards the side of vice that people who are interested in the good and the virtue just argue for safe spaces, you know, within that kind of prevailing kind of ethos there, which is bent on vice. But there should be a robust and rigorous kind of not just defensive, but promotion of the good, such that there's even a legitimate use of liberal institutions, you know, to point kind of public life in that direction. Granted, Amari, he's short on examples, you know, when it comes to that. But you can look at the whole history of the United States and see, I think, that his kind of take on the history does bear out. So there's no question that when you look at French's side of the argument, he does see kind of the strength and kind of the future of the Christian position, of the religious traditionalist position in the United States as kind of winning through the courts, you know, defenses, kind of carve-outs from kind of the prevailing ethos. Whereas I think Amari sees that, one, those won't last. And secondly, it puts the Christian in a bad position, which is to say, yet while the culture and the, let's say, the state moves in one direction, we disagree and don't want to participate, so basically leave us alone. But I think Amari's saying, well, look, if this is bad for us, this is bad for everyone. You know, it's not just bad for us because we happen to believe, but as human beings, we think this is bad for everyone. So there shouldn't be just religious defenses of our own practices, but civic arguments for the promotion of what is good for everyone. How you do that? Yeah, again, slow and detailed, but I think that's where the two really, really diverge. So, and it does center over not the question of civility itself, but over the question of neutrality and how it is that liberal institutions themselves have to be governed by a certain view of the human person and a view of the good. That absent that, they just basically becomes a power struggle, which doesn't serve democracy.
So one thing I remember a lot of the commentators about the debate noting was that Amari was coming from a Catholic perspective, and French is an absolute evangelical.
Right.
And I was wondering...
They joked about that a little bit.
Yeah, I was wondering to like what extent those two traditions are relevant, especially considering like, myself as a Catholic, I definitely side much more on French side of the aisle. I was thinking there's
something
in those traditions that
we... Right. I don't know. I mean, I've thought about this a little bit. I could see why you would see a certain kind of Catholic-Protestant divide in their approaches. Why? Well, because I think people want to see in Amari's argument a kind of throne and all that. What's behind all this is a kind of a restoration of a kind of a throne and altar regime, which if you take Amari at his word, that's not what he's for. No. I think he's more, and I think he's still finding his voice in this, and people are helping him to do that. Is to appreciate in a way that perhaps we've forgotten or are not very strong on right now, that liberal institutions, again, can be supported and function well without liberal ideology, you know, so that it's just a fact of history that many of our liberal institutions arose spontaneously well before, you know, liberal theorists kind of developed their own anthropology for which they wanted to kind of justify the perpetuation of certain things like the franchise or, you know, court systems and things like that. I belong to the Dominican Order. We were founded in the 13th century. The whole our whole governance from top to bottom is democratic. You know, everyone in solemn vows, everyone who's solemn professed has a voice, has a vote. Every member votes for who his superior is going to be. Those superiors serve for short terms, and they're term limited. I'm the prior of the House of Studies in Washington. I've got 6 years, and that's it. Then I'm out, you know, and then someone else comes in. And this goes back to the 13th century. I mean, this sense of vote, voice, checks and balances, separation of powers, you know, within a hierarchy, you know, Dominic didn't read John Locke, you know, to kind of... to figure that out. So there is a sense in which, just historically, a lot of our liberal institutions emerged and were functioning quite well without kind of the modern anthropology that was put back onto them to kind of support their perpetuation. I think that's what Amari is trying to rediscover, that there is a way in which the liberal institutions that we all love and kind of cherish, even if it's just kind of a knee-jerk kind of American reaction, you know, in support of these things, can be informed by an anthropology that predates, you know, modernity, that appreciates in a more substantive way man's being made in the image and likeness of God and his orientation to God as his highest good, but also that inserts kind of the functioning of liberal institutions within a thicker sense of the political common good. The kinds of things that were articulated by Aquinas and other medievals, who Aquinas himself was quite aware of these kind of emerging structures. He himself was a Dominican. He voted for his superiors, you know. He was also the cousin of the emperor, you know, and a cousin of the king of France. So he knew, you know, that these things were not all the same, but that within kind of the political reality of Europe, you had kind of a multiplicity of political forms, none of which were absolute, by the way. There was no absolute monarchy in the Middle Ages. I mean, that's something that comes much later. Which you can see why early medievals were then arguing forcefully for liberal institutions at that time, against a kind of sense of the absolute claims of kings, but that's a whole nother history. But I think that's what Amari is trying to get at, ultimately, is to help us to appreciate in a new way for our time that liberal institutions can be supported by an anthropology that's different from that articulated by liberal theorists. That, I think, is a kind of promising. So I don't think that's a Catholic or Protestant kind of proposition. I just think that's a kind of a human and one kind of based in history. I think it's a new moment where we can reappreciate that. Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of merit to the idea that you can't have a totally neutral public square. But I guess my question is, you said Sora Lomari would kind of shy away from the Ronin Alter idea. And I guess why, if you were talking about, like, you can still carve out some neutral space, how do you justify carving out any neutral space at all once you've established that you want to order everything
right,
you want some good?
Right. I mean, I think there are kind of non-liberal, which is to say medieval, justifications for these kinds of things. You see it all across Aquinas when he deals with justice, when he deals with political rulers. What is the virtue that every ruler must have? Prudence, you know. For Aquinas, politics is not a kind of top-down exercise. You don't begin with kind of inalienable first principles that have to be applied 100% in every circumstance. No, you know what the first principles of action are. You know what defines the human good. And everyone has to exercise prudence, you know, in the pursuit of the goods that perfect them, so that their pursuits are appropriate to the here and now, you know, so that the pursuit of the good and the seeking of my own perfection is not some play that I'm kind of acting in, where the script is already written and I just have to, you know, say my lines and, you know, go to where I'm supposed to go on the stage when the script says. No, it's through deliberation and counsel and judgment and command. I mean, all of these things come together in every human act to make it prudential, you know. So too especially for the ruler, you know. So in regimes where you have a monarchy, it's the king, or a regime that's democratic where, you know, the whole citizenry, you know, participates in kind of rule making or law making. There can be prudential decisions that are made that, in light of the fact that this is the highest good, and of course, in dealing with, let's say, matters of religion, I mean, one of the faiths is probably more right than they can't all be right because they all don't say the same thing. So maybe there's one that's more right than the others. But in our public life, we decide not to pronounce on that question because these things are comparable. We can offer a kind of neutrality. That's not the same as saying that's denying the truth claims, you know, of any of the competing religions, or denying the simple truth that every individual citizen is oriented to God, you know. So that one can still, at a natural level, you know, order one's public life. A state can order its public life according to the destiny that every citizen has in God without kind of becoming itself confessional, you know, insisting that every citizen, ascribe to a specific faith. That's why I think you can have a certain neutrality that the First Amendment, you know, grants in terms of the non-establishment of religion. I mean, the thing is, it's just that it's non-establishment for federal purposes of one church, you know, over the others. But it's not a denial that the citizen, in a sense, needs a church, you know, because of his, you know, orientation to God. So that would be a kind of, you know, non-liberal way of supporting something like, you know, the non-establishment of the church according to the First Amendment. So, and I think you can do that without, you know, voting rights, all kinds of other things too. I think again that Amari, I think that's what he's in an inchoate way pushing us, you know, towards. Yeah.
We have time for one more question.
Okay. All right, right here. And if it's short, we'll get to the other one.
Does Aquinas or others provide any criteria for discerning what is a social evil that ought to be permitted for the sake of order in society, and what is to be impermissible by any means because it's just so subversive to the common good that it ought to be rejected? So, like, I know, like, when it becomes incomparable, like, I think Catholicism versus Satanism would be an example of that.
Right, right.
And I mean, how do we discern that?
Aquinas does give an example of something that might be tolerated. Do you know what it is?
I do not know.
Anyone know what it is?
Prostitution.
He gives the example of prostitution, where he says that this is a social evil. You know, it's unchaste. You know, it's at the least, so it's bad for the individual. It's bad for the family, and because it's bad for the family, it's bad for the city. You know, and therefore, governments can legitimately, in so far as it's the role of the regime to coordinate the common work of the citizenry towards the achievement of the political common good, because this practice undermines that, can pass laws against it and punish it, you know, insofar as it wounds the political common good. But Aquinas says that insofar as every sin does in some way hurt the common good, because every sin is in some way unjust, even those sins that we commit by ourselves or by our lonesome, in some way deprive the common good of some due. And therefore, every sin is kind of subject to sanction, legal sanction. Aquinas says that it's quite legitimate in the course of the political life of a given city, in its particular moment in history, according to its own development and good ordering, it can choose not to, you know, act against certain things, because doing so could actually make things worse. You know, so in weaker societies, you have fewer laws, you know, because where passion is inflamed in a citizenry, it's not going to be simply by law that you're going to solve that problem. That you leave some space for, in a sense, passion to burn itself out, for people to learn the hard way, and then you kind of go in and you pick up the pieces, you know, afterwards. That, for Aquinas, that's a more prudent way, you know, to govern a weaker society than just by imposing and passing all kind of laws against vice. I mean, I think our country, you know, had its own experiments, you know, in this regard. I just think of prohibition. But certain things that would always be, you know, I mean, you can, and should always be sanctioned. It would be those kind of gross and direct attacks on the common good. Murder, you know, in all of its forms. Yeah, that's a bad thing, you know. States, you know, cities can't survive if, you know, citizens are just murdering themselves with impunity. I mean, certain kinds of theft, you know, fraud, you know. You can't have a functioning polis if people are just lying to each other, you know, all the time and defrauding each other of goods. That, you know, universally you're going to find laws, you know, against that. So there are some things that just attack, you know, the health of the polis and attack the dignity of the common good more directly than others. And so in prudence, you know, states, regimes can make those decisions and pass the laws that it deems best for itself. I know there was just one question. Do we have time for one more? Do you have your hand up? Okay.
Yeah, I was thinking about your closing statement, which is really beautiful. I'm from California, and I noticed there that I see like an inability to sustain a substance beyond like a truism and have it be considered civil, whether or not it's intended that way.
Mm-hmm.
I think the more we lose shared principles, it's harder to have mm-hmm. a conversation that would be considered civil. So I'm wondering whether like a reasoned conversation in which you're kind of showing your whole hand is always the way to go.
Right.
So kind of in light of that, I was wondering about your thoughts on like humor and dialectic mm-hmm. as methods in that kind of.
Yeah, Aquinas says it's quite at home in dialectic. I mean, that's his whole kind of MO. In terms of his own teaching, at times you see some humor in his writing. Not often, though, but it's there in certain moments. I think a helpful, you know, piece of counsel that Aquinas gives in this regard is when he treats faith. You know, he sees faith as the act of faith is twofold. There's the interior act of belief, the exterior act of confession. You know, both of those constitute the act of faith. You can't just believe internally without confessing, and you confess that what it is you internally believe. So it's kind of a whole internal, external kind of manifestation of one's faith. But when he treats confession, the profession of the faith, he asks the question, I mean, must one kind of live one's life and kind of go through one's day constantly confessing the faith? I mean, is that what the necessity of confession requires? And he says, no, it doesn't. Why? Well, because confession is a human act, and because every human act is subject to prudence, again, to return to that theme, even our confession of the faith is subject to prudence, which is to say, we do the good thing, though, in the right measure, you know, according to the right circumstances, you know, in such a way that those who hear our confession can actually receive it and understand it. And so Aquinas is quite certain that there are certain circumstances where kind of confessing the faith can actually do damage to the faith, because the person to whom you would confess is just not in a place to hear what you have to say. Worse for Aquinas is kind of the one going around like needling, you know, the atheist, you know, through his confession, you know. And so I think, you know, taking that counsel there in the realm of faith, I think we can apply that to general discussions of the good, that prudence has to govern those kinds of discussions. We have to be quite aware of our circumstance and our environment. We have to be quite aware of who it is that we're talking to, and craft our speech and our approach in such a way that actually not only says the true things that the other person needs to hear, but in a way that demonstrates our love and concern for them. Because if they think we're just, if they perceive we're just there to kind of score a point without really pondering how it is that the truth can and should change their life without real concern for them and their own circumstances, then they're just not going to hear it. And so we do have to be prudent, which is to say savvy and wise in how we undertake these kinds of conversations. Yeah. All right. Thank you all.